Generations of school kids would find this unthinkable. But what if there were an alternative to getting suspended?
There's this notion that you're going to share ownership of disciplinary justice and, you know, just increase perspective taking overall. And this is actually something that comes from the criminal legal system and has been adopted into schools in the form of what they call restorative practices.
Welcome to The Pie. I'm your host, Tess Vigeland. Economists are always talking about the pie, how it grows and shrinks, how it's sliced, who gets the biggest share. In this show, we're talking about the most pressing matters of the day seen through the lens of economics. The Pie is a production of the University of Chicago's Becker Friedman Institute. And in this episode, we're going back to the perhaps not so halcyon days of high school. Back to those times when if you did something wrong or bad or really bad, you faced getting kicked out of school for days or weeks as a suspension, or forever if you were expelled. Those were the primary options for school discipline. But there's an evolving school of thought that says maybe there's a better way that will still teach the necessary lesson, but also keep kids in school and have them learn from it. And today we're going to hear about research that says, yes, it just might make a difference.
My name is Anjali Adukia. I am an assistant professor at the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy and the faculty director of the ME Lab. And my favorite pie is probably a pizza pie.
Well, Anjali, I feel like I should roll a clip from the Breakfast Club where they're all in detention for this conversation. But, you know, actually, school discipline is a very serious matter. And we're going to talk today about the most severe form of it, which is known as exclusionary discipline. What does that mean?
So over the last five decades, there has been this substantial increase in the use of exclusionary discipline in schools. Specifically, when we think about exclusionary discipline, it means taking a child outside of the classroom. So that could be through the form of suspensions or expulsions. Suspension means that you have to leave school for, you know, some period of time, often 3 to 10 days. Expulsion means that you are kicked out of school permanently. And the rate of school suspensions has more than doubled for Black and Latina children, over these last five decades. And part of the problem is that research has shown that being in a stricter school can lead to negative long-term harm, such as decreased educational attainment or increased likelihood of engagement with the criminal legal system.
How often are suspensions used in public schools in the U.S.?
You know, over the last five decades, it really has ramped up substantially, where it really was used for a whole variety of perceived offenses. So it could be that you wrote on the walls, or you talked back to your teacher, or you didn't do your homework. And so part of the issue was that it was starting to be used as this tool for, you know, for any kind of, you know, perceived offense. And I say perceived offenses because we don't really know if the offense is something that actually happened or if it's something that was just perceived by the adult who recorded it. And, you know, it's important to remember as well that school officials themselves report that classroom management and discipline represent one of the hardest parts of their jobs. So despite this growing awareness of the potential harms related to suspension, there is this feeling among educators that there has to be some response to what is perceived as undesirable behavior, particularly in a context where 80% of schools report incidents of violence, theft, or other crimes. You know, teachers say the alternative can't be do nothing. So they see themselves facing this trade-off. Do you suspend students and potentially cause them harm? Or do you keep these disruptive students in the classroom and then harm the learning of their classmates? So how do you navigate this perceived trade-off?
You touched on this a bit in an earlier answer, talking about the increase in Black and Latinos being subjected to this kind of discipline. But can you give us a broader kind of look at what the suspended population looks like?
So it is predominantly male. It is predominantly in lower income demographics, you know, students who historically are, get lower academic scores, They are, you know, it is predominantly and disproportionately affecting Black and Latina children, and of course among white children as well.
So in reading through your study, you talk about zero tolerance policies and how that has been part of this increase over the last five decades. What's involved in a zero tolerance policy? Does the definition of that vary by school? What qualifies for zero tolerance? Is it truly like zero, like you can't do anything?
This definitely varies by school or school district. You know, policies are not consistent across spaces, but often it really is. You know, you get suspended three times and you are expelled, or you conduct, you know, what might be seen as a minor infraction, but if it's against the code of conduct in any way, then, you know, you will get suspended. You will be removed from the classroom for some period of time.
So you set out to explore and evaluate a new approach to school discipline called restorative justice. What does that mean, and how long has that concept been around?
Yeah, so restorative justice is really an approach or a philosophy. And the whole idea is that you're wanting to repair harm. You want to restore relationships or transform them, because often they never existed in the first place. And there's this notion that you're going to share ownership of disciplinary justice and, you know, just increase perspective taking overall. And this is actually something that comes from the criminal legal system and has been adopted into schools in the form of what they call restorative practices, because there's not a defined set of practices. It really is about being dynamic for the situation that may be at hand. Because, so for example, you can imagine a world where, you know, there was a specific situation where I was able to sit in on a circle, and it was with this student who had drawn on the walls. And what they had done is they had this student meet with the custodian, and in that, the student got to hear from the custodian the harm that they caused. What was the consequence of their actions, that now this added time for the custodian? They had to work a little later. They had to go later to their child's sports game that afternoon. And so it affected their life. And the student said, gosh, I just thought I was having fun and games. I had no idea the consequences of my actions. And then what they came from that was that this what they call logical consequences. And so they actually shadowed this custodian for a day to really see, you know, what is it that they are having to do during the day? And how is it, you know, what's a part of their job? And so, you know, it just builds greater awareness and connection. You want the offender to be learning new behavior or the appropriate behavior. You know, you want them to be held accountable for their actions. And you want them to also be deterred from doing this in the future. You want the victim or the person who was harmed to feel, first of all, safe. You want them to feel whole again. And then similarly for bystanders, you want them to know what is the appropriate behavior, and you don't want them to actually, you know, exhibit this behavior in the future. And typically, school districts have used this exclusionary discipline, usually in the form of suspensions. And the question is, what does that actually do? It's not clear that the offender is actually learning any new behavior. It's not clear that the victim feels whole again. Maybe they, you know, have a temporary reprieve from the individual, you know, and they might feel safe for those 3 to 10 days that they're no longer there. But, you know, in order for many people to feel that justice was served, at least according to victimization surveys, is that the perpetrator has to actually understand the harm that they caused. And if they're simply removed from a situation, there's never that interaction of where they have to even apologize.
Okay, so you examined outcomes in the Chicago public schools there where you are. Can you describe for us what their program is before we talk about kind of what your data set was?
Absolutely. And, you know, it is important to really think about how Chicago Public Schools implemented this. So, as I mentioned, many school districts have tried this. And, you know, in some places, they literally just said to teachers, okay, you have to stop suspending and you need to, quote unquote, be restorative, you know, take a positive approach. And it's like, okay, how do I do that? And in fact, when you look at teacher training programs, often some of the first classes that get removed from the curriculum are those around classroom management and discipline. And so school officials are saying, look, you need to give us some set of tools to actually put these into place. And so what CPS, Chicago Public Schools, did is they said, you know, we are going to provide coaching throughout the year. We're going to provide this ongoing professional development and support for teachers to really learn how to implement practices, right? And so what this could look like is, and so they had various ways that they rolled this out, but one way was that they did this intensive coaching where they contracted with expert nonprofits who specialize in restorative practices, and they brought them in 2 to 3 days a week for a full year. And there's a distinction between coaching and trainings, right? There are these, often what happens is you get these one-off trainings where you go for 2 hours or 6 hours at the beginning of the school year or at some point, but there's not then an opportunity to really answer those hard questions. Well, how do I deal with this tricky situation? Or how is it that I can think about this interaction?
Could you walk us through what kinds of records you were examining? What is the data set here then?
So this is a research practice partnership with Chicago Public Schools and the University of Chicago Education Lab. And so they have this longstanding relationship of trust and really saying, let's answer questions that are very important to you. And so we had somebody embedded within Chicago Public Schools who was able to collect information about which schools received restorative practices in which years. So first and foremost, the treatment data. But then we also have information, student level information on their demographics, their GPA, their math and reading scores, their responses to a school climate survey, which tries to record their sense of membership within a school. Like, do they feel like they belong? Do they feel a sense of trust with their teachers? Do they feel that their peers behave in a certain way? Do they feel that school is safe? This also has information about disciplinary actions, whether they have out-of-school suspensions or in-school suspensions, their attendance. We also have information from Chicago Police Department, which is at the child level, because there may be children who are not in schools, which give us arrest information and the location of such arrests. So, you know, did that arrest happen on school grounds during school hours? Did it happen outside of outside of school hours, which really then allows us to think about whether or not these school policies are not just affecting what's happening within the school, but if they are actually leading to these conditions to shape student behavior outside of school as well.
Well, let's talk about some of those findings. When these restorative justice practices are in place, what do you see in terms of changes in suspensions and or arrests?
We see decreases in out-of-school suspensions without increased classroom disruption. And that is really important because, you know, critics often say, if you are now keeping these previously seen disruptive students in the classroom, that is actually going to disrupt the learning of their classmates. And we don't actually see that. So, and if indeed that's what's happening, we also see increases in perceptions of school climate, where students do indeed feel a greater sense of belonging, that school is safer, that there is increased trust between them and their teachers, that their peers behave better. And this means that students are not only more likely to be in school, but the days that they are in school are more likely to be better days. But importantly, we see a 15% reduction in arrests outside of school for both violent and nonviolent offenses, which is a substantial drop and really suggests that schools are having an impact well beyond the classroom.
So, you know, Anjali, when I think back to high school, I would kind of automatically assume that if a kid knows that they're not going to get suspended, that that's not on the table, that that would kind of give them permission to act out even more. But you're saying that the opposite happens.
And it's possible that in part it's because this is not free of consequences. There are consequences. It's not that nothing is happening. If in some ways, it's hard to know, is a suspension necessarily a good or a bad thing? I mean, if a student didn't want to be in school, maybe a suspension is the best way to go. And so the thing about restorative practices is that it is actually teaching children, you know, how to behave, but it also might be just teaching teachers how to see their students differently. You know, separately, one might say, well, you know, is it that you're just seeing a mechanical effect because now teachers were told you're not supposed to suspend? But the fact that we see these changes in terms of reports of school climate and arrest outcomes outside of school gives us some sense that there's something meaningful and substantive happening here.
Is it at all possible to say what this kind of program does in terms of, you know, really long-term, genuine behavioral change? And if so, how is that measured?
We would love to be able to measure long-term outcomes, and that is something which is on the docket for, you know, for future analysis. And part of that has just been about getting data. You know, the first year of implementation was 2014, and then it was actually a staggered rollout over time, you know, and then COVID comes along. And so in part, that adds a bit of complication in terms of thinking about longer run outcomes. But, you know, we do plan to look at graduation or, you know, other kinds of long-term outcomes. But, you know, it is still relatively recent that, you know, we're not going to be able to look at yet, like long-term labor market outcomes and whatnot.
All right. I want to go back to that earlier question about the suspended population and what it looks like. We talked a bit about some of the racial divides. What, if any, of those kinds of divides do you see coming out of restorative practices? So who is benefiting the most and the least?
We see the most benefits for Black students, especially Black male students, where you see substantial reductions in their out-of-school suspension days, their likelihood of being absent or being arrested. We see increases in their math scores. Where we really don't understand is we actually see these potentially negative impacts on their reading scores that are marginally significant. And so we're trying to understand that further.
Well, we've talked about kind of the ramifications of this for the students. What about the teachers?
So because of this research practice partnership, we have had the privilege of being able to talk with teachers, talk with coaches, you know, talk with people who are, you know, actively engaged in this work. And some stories that we would hear, you know, there was one in particular, this person who she said, well, when I was a teacher, I was told that I had to use restorative practices. And I was so frustrated because you're telling me I have to do this fluffy duffy stuff. And it's going to actually make my job harder. And she said the absolute opposite happened. It made my job easier. And now she is a restorative practices coach because she believes in it so much. And we would hear these stories again and again where teachers really believed that this was going to just make it very hard. Or now I have to do this restorative circle in the morning, and that's going to take away some time where I can actually be instructing my students. But actually, it made me understand where my students were coming from in a more fundamental way.
So what kind of policy recommendations might flow out of this research? How do you summarize the debate between punitive or retributive discipline and restorative justice discipline in schools?
So it's also important to remember that restorative practices is not a panacea. But it does represent an opportunity for policymakers and practitioners to look at its promise for possible ways of, you know, actually achieving what our ideal goals are. If we want students to, you know, really repair whatever harm might be caused, to transform the relationships that are within a community and really have everyone share ownership over whatever the notion of justice is, then this does provide one potential model for potentially moving forward. It is important to remember that implementation seems to matter, where, you know, the most intensive and prevalent of the of the RP or restorative practices schemes where they had this ongoing professional development seemed to matter the most. And so we have to remember the adults who are tasked with providing a conducive learning environment, and how can we really support these educators in doing this job? And this is one potential set of tools to really help them.
Well, Anjali, it's always a treat to talk with you. Thank you so much for your time today, and I will not be sending you to the principal's office.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us about our study. It's always wonderful to talk with you, Tess.
The Pi is a production of the Becker Friedman Institute for Economics and part of the University of Chicago Podcast Network. If you'd like to keep in touch with the latest economic research from the University of Chicago, you can visit bfi.uchicago.edu/subscribe. And of course, you can subscribe to The Pi on any of your favorite podcast platforms. If you're getting a lot out of the research that we discuss on this show, there's another University of Chicago Podcast Network show that you should check out. It's called Capital Isn't. This podcast uses the latest economic thinking to zero in on the ways that capitalism is, and more often isn't, working today. From the morality of a wealth tax, to how to reboot healthcare, to who really benefits from ESG, Capital Isn't clearly explains how capitalism can go wrong and what we can do about it. Listen to Capital Isn't, part of the University of Chicago Podcast Network. Our theme music was composed by Story Mechanics, production assistance from the BFI Communications team. I'm Tess Vigeland, your host and executive producer. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.